KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to the Business Podcast. You know, KCRW produces another podcast that you might want to check out. My frequent banter buddy, Michael Schneider, hosts it. It's called The Spinoff. It's about television, industry insights and trends, and shows that we watch or shows that we don't. Find The Spinoff on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
There was a point at which there was even a discussion, you know, well, if this were Marvel, we would do it this way. But it was never, because it's Marvel, you have to do it this way.
Big Hero 6 is the first Disney animated film inspired by a Marvel comic book. But it wasn't marketed that way. Producer Roy Connolly and top Disney animation executive Andrew Milstein explain why. But first on the news banter, Golden Globe nominations are out and the Sony hack attack continues to wreak havoc. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So, Michael, let's start with the Golden Globes. In the past, they have been quite laughable on occasion.
And still are on occasion.
On occasion. But this year, I have to say, I feel like they, you know, you can argue about this choice or that choice, but certainly, you know, it's not an embarrassing series of choices. And there are some pandering selections they could have made, and they overlooked those opportunities. I'll mention at the top in the movie category, both Angelina Jolie's Unbroken and Christopher Nolan's Interstellar overlooked, which is sort of hard to imagine in years past.
Especially Angelina, the fact that now she may not even show up to the show. I mean, and they got to think about that. So Angelina Jolie's not going to show up to the Golden Globe telecast? I mean, they completely snubbed her.
Yeah, I mean, that's unbelievable. Now, I'll just run through some of the drama choices. Boyhood, which, you know, people are calling it the front running underdog or something to that effect because it's picking up awards left and right, critics awards and nominations. And, you know, it's hanging in there, even though it came out before many of these other films. The rest of the category is Foxcatcher, which is the DuPont murder film. The Imitation Game, which is about the breaking of the Enigma Code during World War II. Alan Turing doing that, played by Benedict Cumberbatch. Selma, which is, you know, a late entry. The story of Martin Luther King and a historic civil rights march and the passage of the Voting Rights Act is in there. And The Theory of Everything, which is the story of Stephen Hawking. So that's a good raft of films there.
Yeah, and on the comedy side, it's a pretty good group, too. You've got Birdman, you've got The Grand Budapest Hotel, Into the Woods, Pride, and St. Vincent. So sort of an interesting crop as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's no comedy awards in the Oscars. So, and maybe, and, you know, comedies are almost always overlooked and snubbed, oftentimes, you know, when it seems to make no sense to me. But so, you know, some people would like to see that category in the Oscars, but they do have it in the Globes. And sometimes the choices are a little bit like, is that really a comedy? But,
well,
but again, you know, it's none of these are like the pandering choice like the Johnny Depp movie The Tourist, which was like, what? Where did that come from?
Well, you talk about the comedy conundrum, and obviously that's a big deal in TV. And this year's nominees actually shows, you know, what is a comedy, what is a drama? So the nominees in comedy, Girls, Jane the Virgin, Orange is the New Black, Silicon Valley, and Transparent. None of these shows are belly laugh kind of sitcoms that you sit down and laugh at. There are shows that make you feel. They're all great shows, but they're not necessarily sitcoms. So shows like Big Bang Theory, Modern Family,
yeah, which the Emmys boringly reward year after
and
year.
And last year's winner, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, none of those showed up. Now, you could argue, yeah, it's probably time to clear the deck. And it is nice to see some fresh shows, some fresh faces. Gina Rodriguez, the star of Jane the Virgin, so a name that no one had ever heard of just 6 months ago, now is nominated. And Transparent, you know, Jeffrey
Amazon
Tambor.
Amazon breaks through finally, too.
And Jeffrey Tambor, the role of his career on deck to possibly win that Golden Globe. So some really exciting choices this year.
So Birdman got the most in overall numbers. Maybe we could make an argument at this point that Birdman and Boyhood are facing off against each other for Oscar, but it's still a little early.
Yeah, and I would say it sounds like Selma could be a spoiler as well.
Yeah, that could slide in there. And, you know, some people are actually competing in two categories. Bill Murray is nominated in comedy for St. Vincent and in the TV category for Olive Kitteridge, the HBO miniseries.
And Julianne Moore, in the meantime, is nominated in drama for Still Alice and in comedy for Maps to the Stars.
And I'm going to use the mention of Still Alice, which is a kind of a small movie about a woman who is succumbing to Alzheimer's, to talk about the ongoing unbelievable story. We've talked about it before. We'll talk about it again. This Sony hack attack. That movie, Still Alice, is one of the five that were leaked online by whoever has hacked into Sony Pictures and really just not only paralyzed the studio, but exposed it to so much damage that I don't believe it is possible to calculate the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that has been inflicted by these leaks, and not just of films, but of all kinds of documents, information about people's social security numbers, salaries. I mean, soup to nuts.
This has become a PR debacle, too. I mean, Sony is the victim, and they were looking like the victim. But now, unfortunately, because of a lot of these leaked emails, we're starting to see the dark side of some of the executives. And they've already had to come out and apologize for a number of things that they've said.
Yeah, aside from a bunch of name calling, I mean, there was by now an already storied exchange between producer Scott Rudin and Amy Pascal, the head of the studio, over Angelina Jolie, in which Rudin calls her all kinds of names, and producer Megan Ellison. He's got a few choice words for her. I should mention that I've been told he had a few choice words for me, which I'm sort of flattered because I'm in quite a good category. And then there's this hugely embarrassing, there's already been an apology for this, what was meant to be jocular exchange about Barack Obama.
Yeah. So the exchange between the two on Barack Obama, basically, they started making jokes about the kinds of movies that Obama would like. And of course, they mentioned movies with African-American casts like Django Unchained and The Butler. And it got rather racist. And so they've obviously, like you mentioned, had to apologize. But that hasn't stopped a number of people from criticizing them and saying these weren't just racially insensitive. This was racist. And, Shonda Rhimes and some folks have gone on Twitter and said, how is this any different from the kinds of things that Donald Sterling was accused of saying earlier in the year?
I mean, the context, maybe I'm being too soft on them. I think it reads to me like extremely silly. Amy Pascal was on the eve of attending an Obama fundraiser. They obviously are both devoted Obama supporters, and they're not Sterling, but you could argue, I think this was an appalling taste. But the problem is, I don't know that, honestly, this is breaking so quickly, I don't even know where we'll be in a few days, but can you survive this type of terrible publicity as the sitting head of a studio?
And Kim, if this is truly about North Korea being unhappy with The Interview, the movie from Seth Rogen and James Franco, then this better be a pretty good movie, because Sony is taking it on the chin quite a bit for just releasing
this. The most expensive movie in terms of damage done. I mean, the other thing that I think is very questionable about what the impact is going to be on Amy Pascal as head of the studio for many years, and in some quarters extremely popular and supporting great films like The Social Network, Moneyball, I mean, some truly quality films. But, you know, there is a lot of back and forth that is leaked between Sony in Tokyo and Amy Pascal about, is this in good taste? Is this going to cause a problem? The LA Times reported that they were warned by the federal government that this could seriously be a problem. North Korea warned them. So do you kowtow to a dictator? You can argue no. But as a corporation, are you helping your shareholders when you open yourself up to this kind of attack?
Yeah, and all of this is already out there. It's already in the open now. So to some degree, can you take it back?
And every single document financially will be scrutinized. Who knows where it ends? Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine. The imaginary city of San Francisco, a mashup of San Francisco and Tokyo, is the setting of Disney's latest animated movie, Big Hero 6. Don Hall and Chris Williams directed the film, which begins by exploring the bond between Hiro Hamada, a brilliant but unmotivated young inventor, and his studious big brother, Tadashi.
This is the first test of my robotics project.
Stop!
The seventh test.
This is Tadashi, my older brother.
33rd test.
Wait, stop!
This is the 84th test.
Hello, I am Baymax.
It works! This is amazing!
Baymax is a friendly robot, soft, inflatable, and caring.
I will scan you for injuries.
Don't scan me.
Scan complete.
Unbelievable.
You have sustained no injuries. However, your hormone and neurotransmitter levels indicate that you are experiencing mood swings, common in adolescence. Diagnosis? Puberty.
Whoa, what?
Of course, life gets complicated for Hiro and Baymax, who team up with Hiro's schoolmates in an epic battle with a mysterious villain. Our guests today are Big Hero 6 producer Roy Conley and Andrew Milstein, president of Disney Animation Studios. They're Disney veterans who were on board in the old days of hand-drawn animation, long before Disney acquired Pixar or Marvel. It was in the Marvel Library that co-director Don Hall found inspiration for Big Hero 6. The film is based loosely on a little-known comic book, but the Marvel connection isn't promoted in the film or even mentioned in the marketing. From the start, producer Roy Conley says, it was clear that creative control would belong to the animators, despite Marvel's great power at Disney.
They allowed us to actually take the property and make it our own. That was one of the discussion points early on, was we were going to make this a Disney animated film and not necessarily a Marvel film. But Joe Quesada, who's their chief creative officer, came in and was at every screening that we did, as was Jeff Loeb, who's in charge of television animation, or
right.
rather
and
television
it wasn't
entertainment.
About checks and balances anyway. You just want to have great creative minds at the table with you. So they were woven into what we were doing, and we wanted their feedback to push the story.
Did they give feedback?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And
absolutely.
Did you just say, yes, that sounds good?
No. It's never that way. It's never that way.
You know, the way we make films at Disney, it's director-driven. And so we have this incredible thing called the Story Trust. And basically, Joe and Jeff became part of the Story Trust.
So explain that a little more.
Well, the Story Trust is essentially our group of directors, and that group works together as a team on every film. And we screen the film about every 12 weeks. And then we get together with the Story Trust, and we just tear it apart. And so in those meetings, Jeff and Joe would be there, and they were great partners.
And their notes count like everybody else's notes. They didn't get any more or less weight because they were, you know, represented Marvel. They were just, you know, they were at the table with us, you know.
I feel like this is the immovable object meeting the unstoppable force because you have.
Well, we weren't really looking at it in superhero terms.
Because it always comes down to the director. You know, the director gets an opportunity to hear some of the greatest storytellers in this industry give notes, and then the director goes away, and they pick and choose what they want to utilize in the next setup.
So can you give me just a little bit of an example? Like, okay, here come these two Marvel guys, Jeff Loeb and Joe Quesada, and they see an early screening, and they say, make it more, make it less.
Yeah,
Andrew,
you know,
you're shaking your head, but Roy's jumping in here.
No, it's not more or less. You know, they will give an opinion. There was a point at which there was even a discussion, you know, well, if this were Marvel, we would do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never, because it's Marvel, you have to do it this way.
Right.
And we always knew, and they always knew, that we were making a Disney animated film. And that's why we actually removed it from the Marvel universe and
you
created
did not
this
label it Marvel.
Well, and we created its own universe. You know, San Francisco, which is this, you know, wonderful blend of Tokyo and San Francisco, is its own world.
Well, so how was the negotiation? Because it doesn't say like from Disney, from Marvel. But how did you decide to label it? I can't remember exactly how you did label it, so tell me that.
No, it was a Disney animated film.
So there was no breath of Marvel.
No. And it was interesting.
But there must have been a discussion at some point about making it, like, wouldn't that be something?
I think it was right off the bat. It was right off the bat we discussed that we were going to make a Disney animated film and that we were interested in it. Something being inspired by Marvel, not necessarily a Marvel property.
So in the marketing, do you sort of leak it out there a little bit that it's based on Marvel to make Marvel it up a little bit, but not really put it on the movie? I mean, how does that work?
I don't think it was the marketing that did it. I think that there's, you know, we have fans all over, Marvel and Disney, and they were actually tracking it, and they'd come to us, and it was not something that we wanted to deny. You know, Joe and the Marvel gang were a part of what we were doing, and it's like, yeah. They're a part of it. And then you embrace it. There was moments, I mean, Roy, you can describe it in Comic-Con New York where you just don't shy away from it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and the wonderful thing is we got Stan Lee to come in and do a little bit for us at the end. And for us, you know, as Disney animators, we're all geeks.
Right.
And we're basically telling a story about geeks.
Right.
And then we all geek out because we're able to utilize this amazing force and then really turn it into an emotional story that we want to tell.
So you set up this very different, I mean, because originally it was a comic inspired by the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and this post-nuclear group that emerged. And obviously your film has no post-nuclear. I assume that went out pretty quickly out the window.
Very quickly. Because,
yeah.
You know, essentially what we wanted to do is embrace the concept of tech. That was the big thing for us. We didn't want superheroes. We wanted really smart kids. In the original, their technology was a little bit more radioactive, as it were. And in this particular sense, what we wanted to do is tell a story about kids who were thinkers and who worked their way out of a problem with their intelligence. That was early on in the development of the film.
In the film, you end up with this team of, and it certainly feels like the sequel is probably already conceived.
Yeah. Well,
Andrew?
No, the truth is that it couldn't be further from the truth. The effort of making these films is so tremendous, and you really sprint to the very end. And then from the completion of the film on through the marketing is many, many, many months. And there really isn't the time at this point to even contemplate the sequel. And we don't go into the films from the beginning thinking about sequels at all. It's only, you know, after the fact when you get some distance, you know, and if the filmmakers are actually interested in exploring a new idea from a logical departure from where they left.
Well, there was a very logical departure. They finally gelled as a team.
But only if the filmmakers want to move forward. So we don't, like, look at films. We don't greenlight films thinking about the potential of a sequel when they're made.
John being a filmmaker.
John Lasseter.
Mm-hmm. He supports us in that. I produced Tangled, and there was huge hue and cry for a sequel on Tangled. But she'd cut her hair. I mean, it was over. So, you know, within the structure of a major motion picture, you know, the filmmakers decided that, you know, we didn't have anything more to say. Now we go into this. There could be more to say, but quite frankly, the filmmakers haven't had time.
And the other way to think about it is that, you know, these films on average take somewhere between 4 and 6 years to make. It's a big chunk of time. And then going from there, and you're asking a group of filmmakers and writers and story artists and producers to work on something again, you could actually spend close to a decade of your life in the same world with the same characters. And I think it also, at some level, gets fatiguing, you know, for the creators of the films. And they really look to kind of explore, you know, new worlds, new characters, new ideas. And I actually think it's a great place to be, where you don't have that just the burden of having to kind of think of an idea originally based on the potential for creating sequels.
So, Roy, you've been around. Well, I guess you've both been around. But, you know, you were on Hunchback back in the day of
hand-drawn,
Disney. So you've seen a complete change.
The world of animation is great because every film that I've done, the technology has completely changed. And the technology is one element of the storytelling, but what I'm always fascinated with is how the story changes. If you look at the history of storytelling in film, every decade you're seeing differences in how we tell a story, and the technology just supports that.
Well, so is hand-drawn, Andrew, is hand-drawn done forever at Disney?
No, I don't think so. We have such a legacy and hand-drawn. And we actually have, you know, many artists at the studio today. You know, we're close to 900 people at the studio. So we have a lot of artists who come out of, you know, animation, painting, effects, who are part and parcel and kind of tied to our original legacy in hand-drawn, are actually kind of pushing where we go from a tool perspective and also from a look perspective.
But you're saying it informs the computer.
It informs it. You know, using 2D and hand-drawn in the future is going to be contingent on where our storytellers want to take it.
I mean, you can't really visualize a fully hand-drawn, a full feature at this point. That kind of feels like can't happen.
It'll come down to the creator. It'll come down to the director. I think the cool thing about what's happening, the hand-drawn has so informed our CG animation. You know, Glenn Keane worked on Tangled. We had Mark Henn as kind of like our inspiration in terms of acting and style.
In Glenn Keane, you're talking about one of the
great
2D guys.
Amazing,
ever.
Probably. Well, and Mark Henn as well. Mark is one up right up there with him. The legacy has really been an amazing boon, I think, because I think right now the animation that we're doing is really reflective of the past.
Coming up after a short break, Connelly and Milstein on how Disney animation went from eating Pixar's dust to enjoying the glow of the Frozen effect. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Andrew Milstein, the president of Disney Animation Studios, and producer Roy Conley about the film Big Hero 6. As a longtime Disney producer, Conley's job hasn't changed in some ways from the days when animated movies were drawn by hand. He still works with writers, animators, and composers to help bring the director's vision to the screen. But one aspect of his work is dramatically different.
Social media is a totally new. I mean, social media is different from 4 years ago. You know, 4 years ago, we were promoting stuff on Facebook. Now it's about getting into news lines, and it's crazy. You know, we don't necessarily drop stuff on a Facebook page and expect people to read it. We don't necessarily open up an internet site and figure people are going to read it. Really, it's what comes down the pipe when they're looking at Instagram, when they're looking at Twitter. If something comes up, they're going to then follow that path. So it's about dropping crumbs and hoping people will pick them up.
Now, you used to show everything to the famous Pixar Brain Trust. Does that still continue?
You know, it does continue, and we just use it when we need to use it. You know, you have both studios are very busy with their, you know, internal films, but there's special points in time when you really need to take the film and have a whole new set of eyes look at it, and you just
so it's not a routine thing.
It's not nothing.
Yeah,
is,
we never showed it. Yeah. Big Hero 6 never went.
Yeah, there's no mandate. It's a good card to play, though. You know, if you think you're getting a little bit in a rut. And
right.
Even the whole group of people within Disney Animation, you know, not just the people on the film but their colleagues, they may just get so used to what they're seeing that you just need someone else, another group to jog you out.
But I'm right that it used to be absolutely routine.
It wasn't. Nothing was absolute. We used it more because it was new.
Right.
And then it waned, and we pick it up when we need it.
Okay. So, you know, there was a time, obviously, where Pixar was Pixar and Disney was a stepchild. Disney Animation was, you know, I was smiling before I even finished my thought here, because, you know.
I've heard us called a lot of things, yeah. But.
Stepchild. I mean, I think we were the aging aunt, perhaps.
The aging aunt. Okay. That's maybe more appropriate. And then suddenly Disney has surged, and it feels like you're, as somebody said to me, one of the Disney geeks that I know, is like, Disney is doing Pixar's game better than Pixar is.
Yeah. I've been able to see a couple of the next Pixar things, and I think they're doing just fine.
They're doing fine.
You know, I think for us, it's been an interesting journey because John Lasseter brought back, I think, a certain element of DNA that may have gone missing for just a bit. You know, John started at Disney, went away. I think he used a lot of the DNA from Disney in creating Pixar. John has brought back a studio that is director-driven, filmmaker-driven. And in that, I think we found freshness again. And there's been a certain maturation process that John brought to the studio.
Yeah. So we've been working with John Lasseter and Ed Catmull for close to a decade. And we had a lot of work to do internally at the studio to really try to figure out, you know, how do you truly unleash all the creative potential at the studio? And we've worked hard as a group to figure out, you know, what those dynamics are. And it really started before the release of Tangled, because you have to look at it as a progression from Tangled through Wreck-It through Princess and the Frog and Frozen and now Big Hero. So we've actually learned. We're learning more, mm-hmm. You know, how to behave as a group.
What is the lesson? What was learned?
I think the lesson really is to be fearless communicators. If you had to boil it down to is really trust each other and don't be afraid to communicate to each other what you see that's flawed. And understand that when your colleague gives you those notes, it's because they want the best for you. And that's a much easier lesson to say than it is to actually embrace
Absolutely.
And do. So many people will tell you, give me your notes. Give me your feedback. And you, no problem. And then when you listen and you wait for those notes, there's a lot of trepidation. So we actually had to, you know, get used to the idea that people you work with every single day for years, you can be comfortable saying that's not good enough. And here's some suggestions about how to fix it. And we're getting stronger and stronger in that. But that's taken years to get to that
point. How do you do it? Do you bring in a therapist and say,
well, it's a lot of self-group therapy.
Yeah.
And in many respects, you could say that John and Ed, in the beginning, you know, when they came into Disney Animation, were the therapists, you know, because they had the experience at Pixar, and they, you know, over the years developed a model that worked, and so that we got to literally understand what that core DNA was and figure out how to transplant it and actually nurture it in a very unique culture at Disney Animation with its own history own neuroses, if you will. But we have to understand what that meant and how to infuse it into the organization.
And it's an evolving process.
It's
the communication is evolving and that you open yourself more and more and more. Our story trust meetings, there are bang fists on table. People get very passionate about this stuff. But then you walk out and you go have lunch.
But it is a learned behavior.
It is a learned behavior.
And we're getting better at it. So I would argue that where we are today as a story trust is even better than we were at the beginning of Big Hero 6. And it's intoxicating. And I think that the filmmakers know, you know, that they have to stand on the shoulders of the directors who came before them, literally on the film before them.
But they have to accept criticism.
You have to. If you can't accept criticism, you can't be in the game.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody is going to be, I guess, so vaunted and so legendary that their opinion is the one. You know?
No, it's flat that way.
You have to remove ego from the situation. That's what the wonderful thing about animation is, that egos aren't as inflated in animation as they are in live action.
For some reason, yeah. Is there a Frozen effect now? I mean, where the success of Frozen has just made it the bar impossible to reach, and everything is compared with
we're
Frozen.
We're beaming because of Frozen. we're tickled pink. We're really, really, really happy that we made something that had such a huge impact, positive impact on the world, and people love. I think for Disney Animation, given our history, we're still a very humble organization. So I don't think that because we made Frozen and we were lucky enough to have it embraced the way it was, that we expect that that's the way it's going to be for every film, or that we should get special treatment. I think that people aspire to, you know, that kind of level and impact, but we're not, I would say, silly enough to think that every film we make is going to resonate at that level from a box office perspective. That's a gift that happens rarely.
I'm so proud of the depth of storytelling that's evolving from the studio. And the fact that, you know, what we're really focused on is not the financial success as much as the progression of the storytelling.
I can tell you there are people at Disney who are actually focused entirely on financial success.
Exactly.
I'll tell you internally, though, where the best impact of the Frozen effect is that the team of filmmakers at the studio and the story artists worked collectively to get that film right. So they know that by doing it and what they could deliver on Frozen, they can do it on other films. So you're getting this kind of embedded, not arrogance, but confidence that they can see deeply into what's working and what's not working on a film. And that trust they have in each other applied to any film can elevate it. And I think that's the biggest impact for us of Frozen at the studio.
Is there any effort to go like boy-girl, like, you know, Frozen a bit more female and Big Hero 6 more boy?
I don't think we plan that way. We really don't. I mean, it's funny because I've heard that in the past, like, okay, now Big Hero 6 is the boy film.
Yeah.
Literally,
feminist elements in there too.
There's huge feminist elements in it, and our audience is literally 50-50 men, women. And Frozen, interestingly enough, was 50-50 men,
women.
That
surprises me.
Yeah.
And do you think, I mean, we talked about the internal competition at Disney, but broadly there's been a glut of animated films, not all of them the same quality, of course, but that herd has to thin, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think it has to thin by definition. It feels like to us that there's definitely room in the marketplace, provided that those films really resonate and work, and that the audience will embrace great films. And we looked at it that way internally. It's you have Pixar, you have Disney Animation, you have great, you know, you have Marvel films. And, you know, as long as we tell great stories, there's going to be space in the market. And that's really what we want. We want, you know, animation as a whole to work well, because then it'll bring the audiences in from globally.
Animation is a great medium. It's a great medium to tell a story. You just have to have the right story.
Roy Conley is a producer at Disney, and Andrew Milstein is president of Walt Disney Animation Studios. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Their film, Big Hero 6, is in theaters now. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Wei Guarna and Melissa Morton. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.